another part of personality is the way other people affect you. And if other people have a bad effect on you, you feel pretty strange. You might even feel uncomfortable.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Come on over to Rhythm Shack with Mike Fisher for high energy roots rock, Americana, jam bands, blues and more every second and fifth Monday from 3 to 5:30 a.m. That's Rhythm Shack here on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland and KBOO.FM.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sona Ali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine what emerged from the COP27 meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, with Osprey Oriel Lake, founder of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. She attended the meeting, and she'll assess why rich nations agreed to compensate poor nations at the expense of preserving fossil fuel consumption. Then we'll find out what student loan debtors can hope for as President Biden's debt forgiveness plan remains stymied by legal action. Braxton Brewington, a spokesperson for Debt Collective, will be my guest. Finally, Ife Jie, a hip-hop artist, scholar, and activist, will share how Black liberation elder Dr. Mutulu Shakur has been granted medical parole and released after 36 years in prison. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. As the COP27 UN climate meeting wrapped up, newspapers blared triumphant headlines saying that finally rich countries had agreed to a plan to pay poorer nations but the damage they've caused from disproportionate fossil fuel consumption and carbon emissions. But the upshot is that the meeting did little to nothing on its main mandate to actually stave off climate change by phasing out fossil fuels. My guest is Osprey Auriel Lake, founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network and on the executive committee of the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. She attended at COP27 and has just returned from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Welcome to the program, Osprey.
Thanks for having me on your show.
So these meetings go on for a couple of weeks. They often get extended. There's so many detailed discussions to be had. Let's focus first on the main one, which is that apparently rich countries have now agreed to fund to put money into the funds that poorer nations for years have been asking, you know, that many have sort of seen as a measure of climate justice. Tell us what happened on that front. And if it is sufficient.
Yeah, I think this was one of the biggest breakthroughs we've seen on what's called loss and damage, which is exactly as you say. There is now a funding mechanism that will be there for vulnerable countries as they already are experiencing the impacts of the climate crisis. And it's been a huge call from vulnerable countries, from wealthy countries to pay their fair share for the damage that they have caused because they are the biggest polluters. And so I think it was a victory in that sense. Civil society was very strong. It's been a push by civil society for years and years. So finally this year, we do have a loss and damage mechanism that was in the final cover text. But as you say, you know, the question is it sufficient? And of course it is not. It's, you know, the victory is that we finally were able to accomplish getting loss and damage into the text, but it's completely insufficient in terms of the amount of funds that are going to be needed to really care for and attend to vulnerable countries. And this needs to be on top of the $100 billion that has been promised year after year by wealthy countries to deal with the climate crisis. So yes, it was a victory, but I would say, you know, a lot of civil society has a tepid response because we'll see, you know, how much it really gets funded.
Perhaps if this this milestone had been reached, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, maybe it would have been seen as a right step, and by now we would have been actually tackling the issue of fossil fuels. So what happened on that front? Well, climate change is here. There is no denying that, and in fact, most nations' delegates have sort of stopped trying to deny that because the evidence is all around us. What action, if any, did the COP27 take on meeting the milestones laid out in the Paris Accords and actually begin phasing out fossil fuels?
Well, that was the very giant heartbreaking disappointment of the COP, is that there was an opportunity. There was actually a push to, India started it, to move beyond just calling to end the expansion of coal and include oil and gas, and for there to be a call from countries to phase out all fossil fuels. India began it, the UK entered, the United States entered, and other countries, many other countries. But ultimately, that was not in the outcome documents at all. It was not part of the text. And it was a tremendous disappointment because, as you say, you know, the climate crisis is escalating. We are seeing droughts, floods, hurricanes. I mean, people are in a climate crisis. We saw the floods in Pakistan. I live in California, where, you know, we are on fire here every year, literally with the forest fires. And to see there be such lack of ambition and transformative climate policies at this point is, you know, quite frankly, a disaster, because we're past the point of incremental change. We need to phase out all fossil fuels now. And it should be noted that during the Climate Talks, Global Witness came out with a report sharing with all of us that there had actually been a 25% increase in fossil fuel representation at this COP, up from last year.
Right.
So there was 636 fossil fuel representatives, which is one of the largest delegations that you see at the COP. So the fossil fuel industry was everywhere, and we were not able to accomplish the phase out that was needed.
I understand that even though there've always been sort of fossil fuel lobbyists attending the meetings, that this year for the first time, executives and official representatives were invited to be part of the meeting in Egypt?
Yes. So there's, you know, different levels of entry of conversation, but the role of the fossil fuel industry is just too big at these climate talks, which is why there's a whole movement that was actually started by the youth called Polluters Out. Like, what are they doing at the climate negotiations? They should not be there. We need to be phasing out fossil fuels, not inviting the industry in to be negotiating and being part of the conversation. So that has to change. You know, I will say, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I think it's really important to bring this up because it became a stronger and stronger conversation at this COP. And it's basically a treaty calling for all countries to stop fossil fuel expansion, which is what we need to do if we're really truly going to meet the 1.5 degree target laid out in the Paris Climate Accord. And it was very exciting on a positive note because the country of Tuvalu actually called for the fossil fuel treaty on the floor of COP27. And after that, the interest from parties really escalated. There was multiple high-level bilateral as well as multilateral meetings that happened at the COP with over 25 countries. And our organization is really honored to be on the steering committee of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which just has been growing and growing because we need a additional mechanism in addition to the Paris Climate Agreement to really phase out fossil fuels. And that's what this treaty is about, and it is gaining momentum. Countries are calling for it, and I think it's really important to understand that the Paris Climate Agreement does not include this phase out of fossil fuels, and so we need other instruments to really help countries move on this phase out.
So just to be clear, then, it's the Paris Accord set the goals, but not the mechanism to get there. They didn't lay out specifically the pathway on how to meet those goals, and this non-proliferation treaty would?
Yes, it does. And I think, you know, the Paris Climate Agreement could, you know, we tried really hard to get phase out into the agreement this year. The Paris Climate Agreement could do that, but it's not. It's mostly dealing with emission reductions, which is also very, very important. But we also need to deal with the source. We need to also deal with the supply.
Right. Because emission, if you just focus on emission reductions, then it opens the door for these new untested technologies around carbon capture.
Exactly. And geoengineering and a lot of different technologies that we don't even know if they work yet. It's very dependent on instruments and mechanisms and technology that are not really in place. And I would also say that I think the treaty is really important because we don't have, as we can see, COP after COP 27 years later, that the politics are not there. The politics are not there to take on the fossil fuel industry. I hate to say it, but, you know, we need to keep pushing. The COP is very important. It's a very important place for us to lift our voices and to make demands on governments. But we also need to look at other arenas that we can move forward our agenda because we're simply out of time. We're in a climate emergency and we're out of time.
Tell me about the role of activists on the ground at the COP. Generally, historically, you've had climate justice activists really put pressure on the delegates who are in the halls of power from the outside, try to shame them, try to push them, try to, you know, really be allies to any delegates who might be on the inside pushing for climate justice and addressing climate change. This year, what was it like for those on the outside? I know your organization has been both inside and outside, but give me a sense of what's been outside.
Well, I will say that there were a lot of constraints at this particular COP, given the Egyptian government. And so most all of the activity happened inside the COP because we were not allowed to protest on the streets. We were not allowed to have actions outside of the COP. So there was a lot of solidarity across all the different constituencies of civil society with actions every day. There was just tremendous amounts of actions every day sanctioned by the UN demanding keeping fossil fuels in the ground, putting forward indigenous rights, demanding gender responsive climate policies. All across the board, there was just an amazing solidarity with also African countries, since this was the African COP, and really supporting civil society and grassroots groups in Africa. In particular, we were really uplifting the African Feminist Task Force and their demands for climate justice. So civil society was very, very strong. There was a lot of indigenous peoples. I think that was very important. We need to remember that 80% of the biodiversity left on Earth is in the lands and hands of indigenous peoples. And the way indigenous peoples have been caring for forests, caring for their lands, caring for the waters is essential. And so I think it was very important that we heard from indigenous leaders. WeCan brought indigenous leaders from Brazil and Ecuador and the DR Congo and across the Americas to really have their concerns heard, but also to demonstrate how we need to have a different relationship with nature. And so I think it was really important that there was a highlighting of indigenous voices, as well as frontline leaders from all over the world. And of course, as a women's organization, we were really ensuring that women's leadership was centered. I want to note that we did release several reports during the COP, and I think this issue of decolonization is important. Lifting up feminist leadership is important. We need racial, economic, and social justice at the center of these climate talks. And we were highlighting that, just as one example, study have shown that just a one unit increase in a country score on the Women's Political Empowerment Index, it's associated with an 11.51% decrease in the country's carbon emissions. So we need to understand that the role of women is also key to uplift at these climate talks. And it's very unfortunate because a UN study shows that 74% of the speaking time at these climate talks is done by men, when we know study after study is showing that women's leadership is core and central to climate solutions. And I could go on with stats about that, but it's very disappointing that we still see such unequal gender parity at these climate talks, and it really needs to change.
Osprey, is the forum that the COP offers, these big global meeting, is that the right forum? I mean, increasingly it's coming under criticism that these end up being a massive waste of time and energy and effort, and of course carbon emissions, because everyone's flying out to one part of the world and the results are not necessarily worth the trouble, that we're seeing a lot more progress on local scales, and that trying to wrangle these huge forces, whole nations, to agree with one another is losing proposition. As someone who's attended these numerous times, how do you feel about that?
Well, there's a whole wide range of responses to that, but a concise response would be that I think that yes, a lot of activity and most of our effort and our organization and many civil society organizations is being done at a local level, in our own countries, in communities, from community-led solutions around agroecology to planting forests, to all the localizing of our economies, and all the work that we need to do at home in our communities is front and center. And I couldn't agree more that we need to localize our work and work at the national level as well as the community and local level. That said, I also think it's important that we continue to advocate at the COP, because this is the international space that we have. There's not another platform that really involves all countries, where all countries have an equal say. And I try to imagine us not being on the ground and how much more awful it would be if we were not demanding 1.5 degrees, as an example. That push that happened in Paris happened because of civil society's presence and our push along with vulnerable countries. That 1.5 degree guardrail is essential in our advocacy work, whether we're dealing with financial institutions or governments. Again, this loss and damage victory is a lot because of the presence of civil society. So even though it's not the place where we're going to find all of our solutions, it's a component of the overall ecology of the work that needs to happen. So I would say we need to do both, and even though it's incredibly frustrating and difficult. We're that this is the process that we have, and it's not the only place, but it is one of the places we need to do our work.
What about the role of the United States at the COP? How did the Biden administration play a role? Did it play any kind of a constructive role, given that President Biden ran on a platform of being a climate champion, came into office paying lip service to, you know, really phasing out fossil fuels and having a renewable energy revolution in this country, even though, of course, here in the United States, some of his actions around releasing more oil and gas into the economy to lower prices is, goes against those promises he made. What did he do on a global scale at the COP27?
Well, it's complicated as always. I mean, on the one hand, you know, there was sort of this sense of coming in on a victory lap with the IRA having passed. And, you know, there are components of that that are important. But, you know, there needs to be an understanding that, you know, how we are viewed by other countries is very challenging, because we are an incredibly wealthy country. We are one of the biggest polluters of carbon emissions. And rightly so, other countries and civil society is saying, where's our contribution to the $100 billion fund? We have not really come up with the money that we should be putting into these funds to mitigate the climate crisis. And I think that, you know, the conversation went a little bit better than I thought. We did have the United States move forward with loss and damage, the United States has not been favorable to loss and damage in the past. And the other thing that I found interesting is that when there was a push by India to include phase out of fossil fuels in the text, the United States agreed to that. And we are definitely going to use that as we continue our work here in the United States with the Biden administration, that they were a part of that push for a phase out. So what does that mean at home when we have, as an example, the fight with Enbridge's Line 5 that is being pushed through right now? And what are we going to do? Are we going to continue to be expanding fossil fuel in our own country? The Mountain Valley Pipeline. There's a lot of pipelines still here that are now being addressed. And we need to do something about stopping our own expansion of fossil fuels in the United States if we're going to really be showing the world that we are demanding a phase out. It's got to start first at home. So we're going to definitely be using some of what happened at the COP to push for our national agenda here. The last thing I would say is I think that, you know, Biden needs to call for climate emergency. We need to be doing so much more. In addition to phasing out fossil fuels, we need to be investing more in local community-led solutions. We need to really understand also that, you know, as we're calling for renewable energy, there's going to have to be a serious discussion here in the United States, but all over the world, on indigenous rights and on ensuring that as we mine for all the materials that will be needed for this renewable energy, that we don't continue the colonized version of what we did with fossil fuels, which is to extract what have been called sacrifice zone or sacrifice zip codes. We really need to change our agenda around what does it mean to have climate justice, and where is this extraction taking place, whether it's fossil fuels or the materials for renewable energy. We need to really change deeply how we understand who and what lands we are developing for our energy needs. And I think that discussion has not happened at the level that it needs to.
Osprey, give out a website for the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network and where people can find out more about the work you do.
Thanks so much for asking. It's at WECAN, WECAN, and then the word international spelled out .org. So WECANinternational.org.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. Thank you.
My guest has been Osprey Auriel Lake, founder and executive director of the Women's Earth and Climate Action Network. She's also on the executive committee of the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature. She's just returned from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, as the COP27 meeting on climate ended. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Joe Biden has been stymied in his plans to cancel limited amounts of student debt. After making an August announcement for a cancellation of up to $20,000 in debt, depending on borrower circumstances, a lawsuit stopped the plan in its tracks. According to CNN, about 16 million people have already been approved for up to $20,000 in federal student loan forgiveness, but no debt is currently allowed to be canceled as litigation plays out. Now, the president has turned to the Supreme Court for a decision, but there's little hope given the 6-3 conservative supermajority among justices. We turn now to Braxton Brewington, spokesperson for the Debt Collective. Welcome to the program, Braxton.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, when the announcement was made by the Biden administration, I imagine that folks like yourself might have been critical because it was a very narrow forgiveness plan, but still better than nothing. There had, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, been pauses in repayments of student debt loans. But what was your overall impression of the original plan that Biden put forward? You know, had that plan been allowed to go forward, would you, you know, did you see that as a good first step?
It was definitely bittersweet. We have been pushing for full student debt cancellation and creating a pathway towards tuition-free college so that we don't have to go into debt for education in the first place. Warren and other progressive members of Congress were pushing for $50,000, and you know, Biden settled on $10,000 to $20,000, depending on your current situation, and also means tested it, right? It capped it at $125,000 per year income. So not exactly everything that we wanted, but a great first step and very telling, you know, sort of giving us a proof of concept that we do have leverage in terms of our organizational power and pushing the President of the United States to take action that'll actually take meaningful action in people's lives.
And then a federal judge put the brakes on, calling it unconstitutional. Many are pointing out that this is yet another outcome of the right-wing tilt to the judiciary that the Republicans have been so good at doing, that, you know, under the Trump administration, and just with the Republican domination of the Senate at that time, you saw this push to fill any vacancies in the federal courts with conservative and right-wing judges. So is this one of the casualties of that trend and that push by the Republicans?
Absolutely. I think it's just a continuation of this very rightward slant of the courts that we've seen, from overturning settled precedent with Roe v. Wade to their recent decision with the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, going back to, you know, Citizens United, really. And so what we're calling for is for the Biden administration to, you know, not abide by and sort of throw their hands up in the air and say, if the court stops us, they stop us. That is, you know, we're talking about $400 billion worth of student debt relief. They need to find some other, you know, legal creative ways to make sure that this relief gets into people's pockets.
young folks showed up in full force at the midterm elections to vote for Democrats over Republicans and really made a difference. Some suggest that in part they were inspired by the fact that there is a difference between Democrats and Republicans, and yet, of course, the debt burden that they've been saddled with. And of course, it's not just young folks, because many people in their 40s and 50s are carrying college debt from 20 years past. But mm-hmm. a lot of folks who showed up to the midterm elections and handed Democrats the victory that they won, you know, victory in quotes, in the Senate at least, are now expecting the Democrats to deliver on promises. That's how politics works, right? You elect your representatives and you expect something in return. Is there greater pressure now in the Biden administration after the midterms?
I think so, and just the same amount of pressure that there was before, not to mention the Georgia runoff coming up, you know, the difference between a 51 Democrats and 50 Democrats is actually very important in terms of confirming judges and some other procedural stuff that needs to happen in the Senate. I think young people turning out was a really big indicator to the Democratic Party writ large that, wow, if we actually show young voters that the issues that they care about, that we'll take action on the issues that they care about, they'll come out. And I think that's going to be something that people are already thinking about for the 2024 presidential election, and also, you know, every election down ballot to come.
So what now? What are the ways in which those who are burdened with student debt can move forward? I mentioned that many have already something like 16 million received approval letters, and the Biden administration presumably has sent these letters pending the legislation gridlock breaking. So at this point, what people are they supposed to continue paying those loans off? Do they pause in their payment? What other, and there are, you know, there have been various plans on pausing repayment depending upon whether you are a government worker or not, etc., right? So what advice do you give to those people who are trying to figure out where they stand?
Well, just recently, hundreds of organizations put out a letter calling on the Biden administration to at the least extend the pause on federal student debt payments and interest until, you know, the court system has sort of worked out what's going to happen with student debt. And I think that's really important.
He can do that just on his own, right? With just a stroke of a pen.
Absolutely. He can extend the pause. I think this would be the eighth or the ninth extension that he's done several times, and the Trump administration extended a couple of times. So at the least, right, people shouldn't be having to be forced to make payments on a debt that they were promised would be eliminated, right? So we're saying the pause needs to be extended, and the Biden administration should circumvent, right? So they should go around these courts and cancel debt with a different legal authority. So we've been pushing, you know, the Higher Education Act of 1965 is not the legal authority that the Biden administration leveraged or referenced when they canceled student debt, but the HEROES authority that they use has been caught up in court. Well, there's nothing preventing from the Biden administration from saying, well, we're going to take a similar action with a different legal authority. You know, there's also a bevy of cancellation programs that are at the administration's disposal, that if they wanted to sort of broaden that definition of who meets those programs, they could cancel student debt through those programs. So this is not the you know, end all be all for student debt relief. We just need a Biden administration to, you know, spur some sense of legal creativity to make sure people get relief that, again, they've already proved people for.
Is it a matter of prioritizing it? I mean, it sounds as though you're saying Biden has tools at his disposal that he is not quite enthusiastically using yet.
Right. There are other tools at his disposal, and he should use them. You know, it's great that the Biden administration is appealing the suit and fighting this in court, but it's just not going to be enough should a right-wing court come down with an unfavorable opinion for the Biden administration to sort of shrug or throw their hands up and say, we've done all that, you know, we've can. There's a plethora of other options available to them to make sure that, you know, people get this relief.
So what is the long-term plan for an organization like Debt Collective? You know, assuming that the Supreme Court isn't going to do what Biden hopes it'll do, I don't even know if it's worth discussing given the conservative supermajority. You know, is there a long-term plan? I know Debt Collective has for years been pushing on this issue.
Yeah, well, the first most immediate thing that we're talking about is what a debt strike would look like come January, right? Should the courts come down with some unfavorable ruling or opinion? Should the Biden administration be as cowardice as to not extend the student debt payment and extend who qualifies for that payment? Tens of millions of people are going to be in financially very terrible and precarious situations. And so part of what we're pushing right now is a debt strike, where there's several ways we can sort of safely get to payments as low as $0 a month. And so we've been encouraging people to, you know, find these safe ways where they can go on debt strike and politicize their refusal to pay without putting their credit or their financial, you know, their finances in some sort of bad position.
And how do you respond to those tired arguments that we've been hearing right from the start, that it's not fair that some people have their debt forgiven when some others of us have, you know, returned the money that we owed or that we borrowed?
Yeah, what's not fair is that generations of Americans have had to cough up hundreds of thousands of dollars of money that they don't have to pay for education, when generations before that have actually been able to have free college. And that's what the type of society we should be going back towards, one where everyone can benefit from education because it's a societal public good. And so I don't think that we need to be in the business of making everyone else suffer, right? Punishing everyone else just because a group of people before us did. And we saw this sort of movement play out actually with high school 100 years ago, which is, you know, a very long time ago, but 100 years ago, high school used to cost some money. It was not available and accessible to everyone. And then we expanded that and realized the, you know, countless benefits that come with educating people for free en masse. And now we call it public school, right? We're fighting to make sure that we can do the same thing for higher education, where we can truly make it public.
And of course, this is also coming at a time when higher education is in its own crisis. We know that there are strikes that are taking place of academic workers and graduate student workers and adjunct professors, you know, from the University of California to the New School in New York, because our universities appear to have been turned into, sort of mimicking corporate models where they are underpaying the people who create the product, overcharging the customers, quote unquote, in this case, the students, and having bloated salaries at the top. And you're seeing this crisis that involves workers and students, involves debt and low wages. In many ways, it is a crisis of capitalism, to sort of simplify it a bit, right?
Oh, absolutely. We're looking at a university or looking at a world where the university is functioning both as the place that can educate us, but also our boss and also our landlord, right? And that is not what the university needs to be. We don't need a university that mimics these harsh, punitive, for-profit business models that exist elsewhere. We need something that is actually public and free and reparative and beneficial towards society. And so that looks like making sure people are actually paid a living wage, people can take the classes that are going to benefit them and not are just designed for whoever decided a degree will make the most amount of money. We really actually need to go back to this education and this higher ed model that we had close to in the 60s, right, before women and Black folks and brown folks were able to come on a campus, when tuition was free or there was a very, very low fee. And right now, I think what we're seeing in the UC system is people demanding sort of a return to that era.
Right. I mean, when we've seen this over and over again in so many other places where social welfare, government-backed social welfare, suddenly becomes mm-hmm. inaccessible when women and in particular people of color try to access it.
Exactly. And so I think that's why we use the term racial capitalism mm. at the Debt Collective, right? There is this aspect of gender and race and age and immigrant status and all of these nationality, disability, all of these identity markers that are playing a role in determining who gets what and also determining who owes what to whom. And so that's what the sort of questions that we're trying to ask at the Debt Collective and thinking, you know, what does it look like for a union of debtors to organize alongside a union of workers, right? Because in this age of finance capitalism, where, for example, universities and other businesses can make their money not just from people working for them, but from fees and fines and extracting all types of points where they can collect money from people out of thin air, these sort of finance capitalism. We're trying to really provocate what it would look like for a group of people who are indebted to look at those debts and say, are these debts holding us back? And also, are they a form of asset, right? Is our debt someone else's paycheck? And what would it look like to organize around that reality?
Where can people find out more, Braxton, about Debt Collective if they are saddled with student debt and they want to join in the movement and really politicize, as you were saying, this repayment of debt that they should have stopped paying a long time ago?
You can go to debtcollective.org, and there you can join the union for free or for whatever you can pay per month. You can also be in touch with a group of debtors in your area and sort of join the sort of virtual floor where you can meet other people who are often battling the same situations you are. And as long as Twitter is around, we are on @StrikeDebt on Twitter.
At Strike Debt. Thank you so much, Braxton, for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Braxton Brewington, a spokesperson for the Debt Collective. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. After more than 3.5 decades in prison, Dr. Mutulu Shakur has been granted freedom by the U.S. Parole Board. The Black Liberation Elder was denied parole 10 times before, in spite of clearly not posing any sort of threat to the public. But now, the 72-year-old stepfather of hip-hop legend Tupac Shakur is suffering from stage 4 bone marrow cancer with a grim prognosis. Activists involved in helping to secure his freedom are preparing to bring him to Los Angeles for medical treatment and to be with family. We turn now to Ife Jai, hip-hop artist, scholar, and activist based in LA. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about who Dr. Mutulu Shakur is, aside from being stepfather to Tupac Shakur. What has his role been, and why has he spent 36 years in prison?
Yeah, so Dr. Matula Shakur is a powerful, powerful, powerful living legend that we are blessed to be able to welcome home. So I like to begin first by how he got his doctor title. Dr. Matula Shakur is an acupuncturist by trade. He was able to be a part of a very, very avant-garde movement of using acupuncture in the inner cities of Harlem, New York. And he was trained in Asia and was properly fortified to be able to come back into the community and opened up a clinic called the Lincoln Detox Center. And this was a very powerful, powerful, powerful position to be in, because at the time, our communities were being ravished by drug abuse and drug addiction and many addictions that afflict African-American people in general, like diabetes, heart disease, and things of that nature. And Dr. Matulu, first and foremost, was a healer. He was able to create a space to heal our community and to use it with homeopathic methods through acupuncture. So that was a big deal, because that allowed him to be able to tap into another element of our liberation and our freedom through health and wellness. And then in addition to that, he was a member of the Black Liberation Army, and he was a very, very proud soldier. And he believed in several things in terms of our liberation. And he made dedication to that through his life and his sacrifices. And so a part of this incarceration was not only because of him being a threat, because of his medical abilities and the role that he played in our community as a healer, but it was also because of his political beliefs. And he was cited for 6 counts of charges, one of which was the liberation of Asada Shakur. Another was a charge that he was given in terms of funding liberations in Africa. And he was also charged with a robbery, none of which was he ever seen, involved, or a part of. Many of us believe that he is the true definition of a political prisoner, that many of his citations and indictments were because of who he was in our community and what he represented and what he believed in. And so now we are able to welcome him back and all of the essence that he brings back into the community. But Dr. Matula Shakur is absolutely a political activist. And most importantly, he is a healer, and he has always been dedicated to our liberation.
Why was he denied parole so many times? And it should be stressed that he has been a federal prisoner, right? The majority of, yes, of people incarcerated in the United States today are incarcerated, are kept in state prisons. Yes. And then there is a much smaller number in federal prisons. So this is the U.S. federal government that has kept him behind bars. Why was he denied so many times?
As I mentioned, Matulu is a political activist, and Matulu has always been dedicated to our liberation. And so much of his efforts have been seen as a threat to the powers that be. And unfortunately, he was up for parole several times by the legal standings of how he initially was incarcerated. He should have been automatically eligible for parole several years ago. But they have always found excuses and reasons to deny his parole. The thing that I think that is important to note is that people in power saw him as a threat. They see him as a threat. And it wasn't until he was literally on his deathbed that they decided to give him compassionate medical release. So a part of why he's been denied parole so many times is for arbitrary things that they have made up. One of which, I remember there was a time they denied him because of a phone call, because of a saying that he loves to spread when he's on the phone, straight ahead. And that's always his motto and his mantra when we're on the phone. And so sometimes, you know, they would create all types of ludicrous things to deny him for parole. But the ultimate sentiment has always been, because of who he is and what he represents, the powers that be have saw him and see him as a threat to our community. But the truth is, he is a wonderful asset. He is the crown jewel in our liberation struggle. And so no matter what, we have always continued to fight for his liberation. And we are so grateful that that day has come.
So it sounds like he was kept behind bars, not because he represented any sort of risk to the public, but because of the symbolic value of his freedom to Black liberation movements?
Absolutely. I think that's very well said. And there's so many different layers of that. When we talk about the history of COINTELPRO, when we talk about the history of what the FBI has done to undermine Black liberation movements historically, from the times of Marcus Garvey to the times of the Black Panther Party and to the New African Liberation Movement, this has been a very real circumstance that many of us wrestle with accepting, but it is a very true part of our story.
So what were his 36 years like? It's unimaginable for some, you know, for those of us who've never been incarcerated, to be in that position with no end in sight, to be in there indefinitely, you know, of course, because he had no idea when he would finally be released. What were those 36 years like? How did he keep his spirit alive?
Well, you would have to ask Matulu that himself. But if I dare so speak for him, I've had the privilege of being able to see Matulu several times while incarcerated. And he is what he calls himself is a muddy water alligator. So he can survive in any condition under any circumstance. And his spirit is so strong. It is so powerful. When he walks into the room, you feel it immediately. And so I saw him be very disciplined in the way that he took care of himself. He was an avid runner at one point and was running every day. He took a very good care of his health and wellness. He was a very disciplined man. I remember talking to him once about his spiritual background. And he said that I am a Muslim because of the discipline and the regimen of being a Muslim. And so there was so many things that I'm sure that he did to keep himself occupied. One of the things that I appreciate that he was able to accomplish while he was incarcerated was a project called Dare to Struggle. And Dare to Struggle was a compilation album that he put together to honor his son, Tupac Shakur, after he had passed away. And Dare to Struggle was a wonderful CD that we put together, and several artists were a part of it. And a fun fact that people may not know is that at one point, Dare to Struggle was touring around the southern part of the United States, and we were able to go to the album release party for a Better Days album that Tupac had put out. And at the Better Days concert, we didn't know it then, but later we realized that a part of us that were representing on stage, one amongst us was Nipsey Hussle. So Matulu was very instrumental and many hip hop artists in their careers, and not only Tupac, but Nipsey Hussle as well. I remember having witnessed that moment of Matulu talking to Nipsey on the phone. And at the time, he wasn't Nipsey Hussle. He was Concept, the forever the ghetto's poet. He was at the very beginning of his career. But Matulu Shakur absolutely was instrumental in giving him a platform early in his career to be able to express himself and do his music. So Matulu has been able to accomplish so many things while incarcerated. Another piece that he's made that is very critical to our culture is a document that he calls Truth and Reconciliation. And Truth and Reconciliation is a process that's adopted from the South African apartheid, and the process that they did to heal after apartheid was legally abolished. Now, many of us know that there's still remnants of racism and segregation in many parts of the world, especially in South Africa. But the process of Truth and Reconciliation was something that Matulu felt that we should adopt here in the United States, to be able to go through that same process and response to the conditions of the African in America. So I think that was an awesome contribution that Matulu put a lot of energy in cultivating and creating while incarcerated.
Tell me about the struggle on the outside to help win his parole. It takes a village, it takes an army, it takes a huge community of people, especially around political prisoners in the United States. You know, we think of Mumia Abu-Jamal or Lynette Peltier, and there are just masses of people who have worked tirelessly for decades to help free them. And I imagine the same has been true for Dr. Matulu Shakur as well. Tell me about that struggle.
Absolutely. So I, again, am humbling myself because I have the opportunity of speaking with you, but there are several people that can be in this seat. And many of them are members from an organization called the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. They are the instrumental body of people that have pushed much of the efforts to get Matulu out of prison. And I know that they're... It's so much commitment, so much time, so much organization. organizing, so much follow-up to be able to have that type of momentum. And so we want to give a special shout out to the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who has chapters all over the nation, particularly a sister named Monifa, a sister named Taliba, and I don't want to miss anyone's name, a brother Lumumba, a brother Jomo, brother Watani Tahimba. These people have been on the ground daily, monthly, over the years, consistently fighting this battle. We've signed petitions. We've held rallies. We've had concerts. We've had so many things to bring awareness to Mutulu Shakur's case and to be able to get the public's opinion to be familiar with why it's important for him to be free. So that campaign has been going for years. For years, diligently and consistently. And the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement members have been absolutely spearheading those actions. And so we're honored to be able to have such dedicated soldiers, such dedicated people, such dedication in general to all of our political prisoners.
So what is his prognosis right now? And in a few moments, we'll also give our audience information on how they can help in the bringing him to Los Angeles, either financially or morally or both. But what is his prognosis? I mentioned he has stage 4 bone marrow cancer. That sounds really awful.
Yes. Well, his spirit is strong. His spirit is strong and his spirit is excited to be able to come to the other side, to be able to be with us, to be able to be with family and with community. And so although his body might be at a disadvantage, his spirit is 100% strong. And my belief personally, if I dare so say, is that Mutulu has every means in his toolkit to be able to heal himself. He is a powerful master acupuncturist. And so we believe that although that his body is going through a change, that once we bring him home, we will be able to make sure that he has what he needs to be healed. And whether that's someone else facilitating his healing, him telling us how to heal him, or him healing himself, we believe healing is absolutely there for him. And so, you know, there's been a process, but he has gotten to the last leg of that process, and healing is absolutely the next step.
What is the current status right now? When is he expected to be freed? And tell me about his expected journey to Los Angeles.
Yes, so we're anticipating a release for December between the 15th and the 18th. I've heard several dates. Mutulu himself has told me that he has a bit of a window. And so we anticipate that he will be in Los Angeles no later than December 18th. And so we are raising funds right this very second so that we can accommodate his transportation. Because of his condition, we want to make him as comfortable as possible. And so that might mean being able to have medical transportation from a Kentucky's prison in, I think it's in Louisville, Kentucky, in order for him to get to California. We want him to have medical transportation to the airport, comfort while he is flying, and then obviously being able to have transportation from LAX to his physical home. So that's a part of the fundraising efforts. We anticipate that we should have everything together before his arrival, but between December 15th and December 18th, he will be home.
And so tell me, for our Southern California audience, LA is where this program is based as well. How can people participate? I understand there's an event that's been planned to welcome him.
Yes. So first and foremost, we encourage every single person who is under the sound of my voice and listening and watching this program. If you are interested in supporting Mutulu Shakur, please visit MutuluShakur.com. That is the official hub to be able to get all of the donation information. We have tax deductible donations and we have donations just straight out the book. So if you are encouraged and inspired and want to support this effort, please visit MutuluShakur.com. And if you're in Southern California, if you want to come and travel to the sunny place of LA, then we welcome you to be with us on December 10th. We will be in Leimert Park at Hot and Cool Cafe, and we are having a benefit concert, and we're so honored to have artists such as Aloe Black Maya Jupiter. We have some other local artists that are going to be a part of the event. And we're excited to be able to have a benefit concert to literally raise funds and to support this effort. So again, if you are interested in supporting, please visit MatulaShakur.com. And if you're in LA, pull up on us. We would love to have you. December 10th, Hot and Cool Cafe.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ife. Good luck to you.
My pleasure.
And thank you. And to, of course, Dr. Shakur.
Absolutely. Free to land. Thank you.
My guest has been Ife Jaye, hip-hop artist, scholar, and activist based in Los Angeles. And we've been discussing Dr. Matulu Shakur's getting parole, medical parole. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kits Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow.